Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. It gives me great pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker at the WIP seminar, the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. And tonight's speaker is Maurice Said. Maurice has both his BA honors degree and his MA degree in anthropology from the University of Malta. So he's very well known to us. He's now working on his PhD at the University of Durham. He's completed his field work, and now he's writing up his field work for the PhD. And this PhD is very much concerned with the processes of transformation going on in the rural areas of Sri Lanka after the tsunami. This has led Maurice to spend quite a bit of time studying patterns of violence in the village and patterns of violence which come from outside the village. And my own personal story about Maurice is that even when he was doing his MA, it was very surprising to see just how much internal violence there is in rural Sri Lanka. And as some of you know, the anthropology of violence is now a big and growing interest within anthropology. And certainly, I think that Maurice is going to make a big contribution to that field of anthropology. So he has been looking at violence for some time. He continues to look at it in his PhD. Because what has come across to me working with Maurice on his MA is just how much suicide there is in Sri Lanka. He will tell you more about this, but the rate of suicide is truly extraordinary. And he is going to be trying to understand suicide tonight in terms of the kinship patterns in Sri Lankan villages and in terms of the various factions that emerge in village politics, the violence in the factions of village politics. So in these terms, he's going to be looking at suicide tonight. And we have to say that Maurice has become quite a South Asian expert. He has, quite apart from his academic work, he has spent well over a year working for three different NGOs in three different countries, Indonesia, India, and Sri Lanka. So we're going to be listening to somebody who has a wide range of experience. Maurice, welcome.
So, thank you very much, and thanks for having me and for coming to the talk. I've timed the talk to be around about 40 minutes in length. And just before starting, I'd like to give you a little bit of a background to suicide in Sri Lanka. There hasn't really been that much written on suicide in Sri Lanka and indeed in South Asia since the 1960s, where there were some sparse articles and papers that were produced. But the majority of work that's come out on suicide in the South Asian context has been in medical journals and in psychiatric journals. The particular interest with suicide in Sri Lanka is that it has, and self-harm in Sri Lanka, is that it has reached epidemic proportions, where the rate of successful suicides has at one point reached well over 46.1 per 100,000 capita. And just to give you an idea of this, the rate of suicide in Malta is of 6.3 per 100,000 capita, and that's going back to 2008. This paper represents one in a series of papers which is trying to wrench the topic of and the study of suicide from the hands of solely psychiatrists and medical practitioners and to bring it back, as Durkheim had done, to the realm of the social and to look at the ways it affects kinship structures, the way it affects social relations, and the way they can in fact become narratives of morality and of other more extensive social relations. So with that, I'm going to start off with a first section, which is giving a background to the context of Sri Lanka and to the context of kin relations and suicide. So, Sri Lanka has one of the highest rates of homicide and suicide in the world. suicide has been identified as an empowering tool in the hands of the powerless, and a method through which to exact public retribution for injustices committed against the victim. And for more work on this, one can refer to Counts, Giddens, Spencer, Widger, Jean Mersek, amongst others. Suicide may also encompass interchanging dualities: the transfer of shame from the victim to close kin, the restoration of honor through a dishonorable act, and the transfer of vulnerability from the individual to the family. This paper builds on observations, case studies, and narratives collected during a one-year period of post-tsunami rehabilitation work conducted in the southern Sri Lankan district of Matara from November 2005 to November 2006, a further period of 6 months of fieldwork in the same area in 2008, short visits in 2009 and 2010, as well as a year of fieldwork in the area in 2012. Narratives were collected from two coastal villages in the vicinity of Matara town, as well as one IDP, that is, internally displaced persons, tsunami camp. The tsunami of 26 December 2004 resulted in the deaths of 1,088 persons, 165 missing persons, 29,550 displaced persons, and 6,506 displaced families in Matara district alone. The villages surrounding Matara town, where the research took place, are composed for the most part of fishermen, divers, masons, and day laborers, and small guest house and restaurant owners. I'd like to mention before continuing as well that the names of peoples and places over here have been changed at the request of the participants because of the nature of the topic. In particular, this article draws on narratives collected from Po, a coastal village which has started increasingly to cater to tourists following the tsunami. The control of resources, exercise of power locally, and the protection of one's kin are all dependent on the range and extent of social networks created. The strength of a network is proportional to the status of key individuals at its helm and their ability to uphold the moral integrity of the family unit. The moral integrity of the family unit and its associated social network is dependent on the avoidance of actions and events that invite lajja, shame, and thus the loss of nambua, status. It also entails keeping internal domestic conflicts out of the public eye. I argue that the structure of kin networks and the codependency created by kin relations and obligations has resulted in youths and young men and women utilizing suicide as a tool to publicly question the moral integrity and authority of the family, whilst at the same time providing them with an avenue to challenge the hierarchy inherent in kin-based social networks. The result is a transfer of vulnerability from the suicide victim or suicide attemptee to this family network. An understanding of the structure of kin relations is therefore integral to this argument. And with this, I lead on to a section that discusses kin relations and kin networks to give you a better understanding of the transformations that are taking place. The family unit, which incorporates immediate blood kin, siblings, parents, children, and spouses, is a significant aspect of Sinhalese local life. The economic activities and social networks of individuals are all centered around, and to an extent, controlled by it. Maternal aunts, called Loku Amma or Punchi Amma, are considered to be a second mother, Amma, and paternal uncles, Loku Tata or Bappe, are considered to be a second father, Tata. Parallel cousins are referred to as Akka, older sister, or Nangi, younger sister, if they are girls, and Aya, older brother, or Mali, younger brother, if they are boys. It is taboo and considered incest to marry or get involved sexually with parallel cousins. Cross-cousin marriages, however, are considered ideal. These forms of endogamous unions strengthen internal kinship bonds. Within the village, cousins' cousins are also often classified as kin and are referred to as cousins too, thus extending one's network of kin. It is also common to find up to four generations living together under the same roof and or in the vicinity of close kin. Respect for one's parents and the elderly is a core family value in Po, and children are expected to take care of their parents in their old age. This is rarely considered a burden, and individuals are conscious that they too will grow old and become dependent on the care of their children. Such is the strength of the bond between children and their parents that many still sleep in the same bed well into their adult life if they do not marry. In fact, there's one 35-year-old man from Po who is a successful businessman in the nearby town of Matara and unmarried, and he still shares a bed with his mother, and this is by no means an isolated case. Lasantha, a local guest house owner, and his older brother both live within 50 meters of their parents' house, and their wives usually congregate together with Lasantha's mother to share the chores in each household. They all share the duties of taking care of the children, and meals for all three households are prepared at Lasantha's mother's house. In this way, to quote Baker, a mutual feeling of dependence is created, although it also limits opportunities for individualism. It is also customary in Po that the youngest son, even if married, remains in his parents' house, and it is his duty above all to take care of them in their old age. This is the case with Lasantha's younger brother, Susanta. Younger siblings also have responsibilities towards the oldest brother, whom they must obey on a par with their father, and who eventually will take over the duties as head of the family. Although the nuclear family unit is central to individual identity, non-blood kinship ties also play an increasingly significant role. Non-blood kinship in this case incorporates close family friends that form part of a nuclear unit's social network and extended support group, and includes other locals with whom there are long-standing ties of reciprocity or family friendships that extend beyond a single generation. They may, again, also include cousins' cousins. Non-blood kinship ties are called into play in the settlement of inter- and intra-village disputes and are essential in the establishment of what I call a dominant family network. A dominant family network is the nuclear family unit that has the most far-reaching social network encompassing both blood kin and non-blood kin, and therefore the widest arena of support, influence, and access to material resources. Kin relations are determined by what I term as either open or instilled obligations, where open obligations refer to voluntary and usually public shows of alliance and support, generally associated with non-blood kin, whereas instilled obligations refer to duties and acts of reciprocity performed between blood kin that have been instilled in family members since a young age, and where reciprocity is not necessarily defined by a specific time frame, thus the favor may be returned at a much later date or never at all. The obligation to financially aid close kin can turn out to be altogether quite debilitating. When business at the guest house is slow and therefore money is lacking, Lasantha will go to his bappe's, who is his younger uncle's store, to collect food items on credit. At one point, both Lasantha and his elder brother were taking items on credit for a period of over 2 months, and together they piled up a debt to the bappe of 40,000 rupees, which is around 250 euros, which they were unable to repay and which had placed their bappe in a very precarious financial situation. This is an example of an instilled obligation, where Lasantha's bappe, as the younger brother, is required to help his older brother's children, and where failure to do so may result in him being cut off from the support of the extended family network, which in this case happens to be the dominant family network in the village. The absence of government representatives in the village has resulted in the dominant family network being the main unit of local power and authority. However, the strength of the network is dependent on key individuals within the nuclear family unit and their ability to create non-blood kin connections with persons and families outside of the village space, essentially leading to the network defining social space and boundaries rather than vice versa. As Brown notes, and I quote, effective connections with outside politicians became relatively more important as a basis of power within the village, close the quote. Therefore, the term paula, family, may in fact be used to refer to one's wife, the whole nuclear family unit, or the whole village, and in the case of Po, the family network. Thus, the use of the term paula itself suggests a conscious recognition by locals of the internalization of village space and non-blood kin in their considerations of whom and what constitutes the family. With this in mind, suicides play a decisive role in the reorganization and transfiguration of family networks, local power structures, and social space. And before actually getting into the case studies of suicides, I'm going to just look very briefly at shame and the fluidity of status. In Po, suicide is a way of humiliating close kin by inflicting shame on them. It is an indication of poor control in terms of family relations, an absence of respect, and a shameful way to die for Sinhalese Buddhists. Locals believe that suicide is akin to murder, as in killing oneself, one is also killing the Manokaya, the other person that resides within us, and that is responsible for our subconscious thoughts. Now, I'm not going to get into this further now, but if you want to get into it in the discussion period, I'd be more than happy to. There are a couple of very interesting narratives that I've managed to collect where they talk about this Manokaya as being responsible for dreams, as coming alive in dreams, and as coming alive when the conscious is asleep. There's some very interesting examples, but we can get into it later. However, it is also accepted as common local knowledge that the events that lead to suicide are the direct effect of some injustice caused by the immediate kin or spouse. Suicide within this context may also be portrayed as opposed to socio-cultural norms that dictate obedience and respect for one's elder kin, especially parents. Here, parents are made to watch in horror as their child's life is slowly extinguished, a situation best described by what Obeah Sekar terms the ambivalence of kin. And by this, the ambivalence of kin, Obeah Sekar is referring to the dependency that is created on family to create stability, but at the same time that invites a variety of very brutal violence that is targeting family members. So it's kind of contradictory in a sense. The fact that most of the suicides are carried out by youths is significant in itself. They are dependent on the support of their families and are socially vulnerable without the latter. An adult is decisively less dependent in that in most cases they have a job, a wife or husband, and a stronger network of relations built up over time and therefore some degree of independence. Youths, on the other hand, are at the mercy of their immediate family, and their only option for confrontation and retaliation, in their view, may be suicide. Essentially, a suicide weakens the global kin network by disrupting the social relations that the immediate family has created within the locality. Lajja, shame, reduces social status and strains relations of trust between village units. Since suicide essentially signifies a failure to adhere to globally accepted sociocultural norms, in other words, to instill respect and obedience and uphold the moral integrity of the family unit. Therefore, reciprocal respect is greatly diminished. This is especially problematic in the case of a dominant family network, as apart from possessing a larger share of economic power and wider kin network than other family groups, they are also expected to uphold the traditional moral values of the village. The most significant among these is respect for the family and the absence of internal violence, values which a suicide contradicts. From a young age, children are inculcated with a fear of lajja, of shame, of being humiliated publicly. Lajja, in this respect, refers to fear among individuals of what will be, is being said about them, about being judged, and it is therefore a significant aspect to take into account when considering locals' self-control and the nature of their actions. Lajja is used here as shame. However, this oversimplification should not exclude its positive connotation, much stressed by Obeah Sekar and Spencer, as a form of restraint from shameful behavior, a form of self-control in individuals' social actions. Spencer argues that lajja is associated with self-control. It is what prevents an individual from resorting to violence or other shameful behavior. Lasanta and his brothers describe lajja as a general term, and its contextual use refers mainly to public humiliation and occasions or instances where one's status, nambua, is challenged. Lajja, in fact, defines one's status, nambua, and may also be used in expressions to describe individual character and traits. Both Lasanta and his older brother Asanka describe the terms lajjai and lajjanedda as being terms used to describe a person's character. Lajjai is defined as being shy and humble or modest, a positive quality, the opposite of having adambara, which is a lack of humility and restraint in public. Whereas lajjanedda, to be shameless, is used when referring to someone who has behaved badly in public and who does not demonstrate enough restraint in his or her actions. Lajja may therefore be seen as a term that is used to talk about actions that imbue shame and to talk about an individual's social position in relation to an event. lajjai and lajjanedda, that is, modesty and shamelessness, on the other hand, are used in reference to individual characteristics that illustrate how a person is expected to act in relation especially to past events and actions and the nature of their relationships and conduct with other villagers. If someone is lajjai, modest, it is believed that they will be less likely to commit suicide or acts of self-harm. They conduct themselves in a manner that is considered respectful to others. The opposite may be said of someone who is lajjanedda, shameless. They are described as selfish, having no concern for those around them, and therefore both lacking shame, whilst conversely acting shamefully. And with this, I come to the case studies of suicide. At this particular case, I've called the case of Kapila, who is one of the main protagonists in the suicide. During my second period in Po, a local friend, Kapila, who worked as my three-wheeler driver on a number of occasions, invited me for dinner at his house one night. His younger sister and her five-year-old son had just returned to live with him after her husband had committed suicide by drinking pesticide a month before. Her husband had been working as a day laborer, making bricks, and she had urged him to try and find another job so that they might afford to buy new clothes and items for her and their son. She had also suggested he ask for a loan from her brother, who was doing good business as a three-wheeler driver. He returned home one night, and his wife asked him for money to buy clothes, at which he broke down crying and ran into the next room where he swallowed pesticide. His wife called for help, and neighbors took him to the closest clinic, where they helplessly watched him writhing in pain before he died a short while later. Pesticides and agrochemicals are readily available in Sri Lanka, and ingestion is a common method of suicide, offset by an impulse reaction of anger or disappointment, what they call shanika kopia, which is, shanika is quick, and kopia is anger. But it's used in a number of different contexts. It can be used to mean a surge of emotion. So sometimes a surge of anger, a surge of sadness, and in some cases even a surge of love. In the context of police, they actually use it on certain occasions to define a crime of passion. So as with many other terms in Sinhalese, you can find a term that can have different meanings across different contexts, and you have to look at the context to be able to decipher the meaning. And often the desire is not necessarily for death, although deaths are fairly common. As Simpson and Sariola note, and I quote here, "Self-harm is symptomatic of a desensitization to violence in a society that has been struggling with major political upheavals for the past 30 years. In Matra General Hospital alone, in the first 6 months of 2007, 286 admissions for attempted suicide were recorded, keeping in mind that these numbers are not representative of the whole district, but only of Matra Town and some neighboring localities." Matra District as a totality has a population of 700,000. So we're talking here about maybe 40,000 to 80,000. And it's also important to keep in mind that a lot of actual suicide cases are not reported as suicide because of the shame that they bring to the family and to the individuals. Most of these attempted suicides were recorded to be the result of ingestion of either pesticides, agrochemicals, or other harmful substances. And the vast majority of these individuals were youths between the ages of 16 and 24. The context in which youth suicides take place have been noted to be similar situations to that of Kapila's brother-in-law. I return to the situation of Kapila. Following dinner and after being given the details of his brother-in-law's suicide, I joined Kapila and his other brother-in-law and two friends in the next room for a drink. Guzzling down arak, a local spirit distilled from coconut, at an astonishing rate, Kapila began to recount his sister's tragic story over again. You see, she was not thinking. She knew he had money trouble, and now I, the good brother, have another two mouths to feed, and she, lajjanedda, is without shame. She doesn't think about me. Suddenly, he called his nephew over and asked, "Tata kohedinne, where is father?" "Tata gie, oh, father's gone, yes?" Shocked, I looked at the friends, thinking this to be a result of too much arak, and to my surprise, they were nodding in agreement. They explained that if her husband drank pesticide, he must have done so for a good reason, and as his wife and the mother, she should have understood his troubles and done her duty, and avoided burdening him with her requests. Further, in their eyes she provoked him. She was to blame, and now she had burdened them. Throughout the whole recital, she stood silently against the wall with downcast eyes. Through his agonizing choice of death, he had transferred Lajja, shame, and responsibility for his problems onto her. In their eyes, the very fact that the suicide was targeting her is a confirmation of her culpability and a justification for her torment at the hands of the community. A shameful death such as suicide in this way covers the victim's family with shame, and in this case directs the focus away from her husband's shameful inability to provide for his family. As I have alluded to earlier, the desire is not always to die, and this is especially the case with the ingestion of pesticide. Ingestion of pesticides and agrochemicals results in a prolonged period of excruciating pain, and the choice of location is a public place in clear view of all. As Kant notes, the choice of location for the execution of a suicide is an indication that the act is not an individual affair, but one that involves the whole community, that the act, and that they are essentially, to quote Kant, expressions of social relationships. All this lends suicide an aesthetic form that unravels the play of social relationships. In the following section, I analyze the aesthetic form and social repercussions of two case studies of youth suicide, one from the village of Po and one from a post-tsunami IDP camp. And I've titled this section The Aesthetics of Suicide, but hopefully in the discussion section I'd wonder if you could maybe suggest a more appropriate title. I'm not so sure that it fits in here. And anyway, The Aesthetics of Suicide. In considering the aesthetics of suicide, what is of interest lies in uncovering the processes and dynamics of the performance that lead the event from involving the individual to involving the community as a whole, and how the suicide breaks and or remolds social relationships. More importantly, what latent social structures and processes does a suicide expose in the current context? With this in mind, aesthetics here should be understood, and I quote Eagleton, not as the study of art or the judgment of beauty, but as the area of philosophy that emerged as a discourse of the body. During my first period in the village of Po in 2006, a young couple aged 16 and 17 took part in a joint suicide. The boy hailed from a lower caste family in the neighboring village, and the parents forbade the union. They continued to meet in secret, and the girl ended up pregnant. They opted to commit suicide rather than face the wrath of their parents. They made their way to the train tracks, held hands, and jumped in front of the oncoming train and were torn to pieces. Family members and other villagers had to take part in the gruesome task of collecting the severed body parts. In Sri Lanka, there is no collection system, and it is considered a duty to take part in the collection of the bodies. The significance of this particular case is that it brought to the fore issues of caste and marriage. Up to a few decades ago, caste still determined social structure, and indeed, a person's occupation and caste could easily be identified through the surname and the form of speech used. In the case of lower castes, a polite and formal tone was used when speaking to people with higher castes. Lower castes would also be given drink from empty coconut husks and made to sit on a lower stool. However, the opening up of Po and surrounding villages to tourism and outside business enterprises has made caste distinctions somewhat obsolete. Changing of surnames to hide caste affiliation has become commonplace, and so widespread that it is rarely taken into account nowadays, even in the case of marriage. I have been told and have noted that this is not the same situation one finds in inland villages, especially in the hill country, and surprisingly also in areas of the capital city of Colombo and the hill city of Kandy. I was surprised to note recently that the younger men in Po had no idea of caste affiliations, and older men talked of caste with a drawn-out sense of nostalgia. They state, caste no longer matters in marriage. What matters now is land, wealth, and friends. However, they admit that this is due to the modernization and opening up of the village to outsiders, and the increased social mobility and geographic mobility that resulted, whereas further inland and in poorer villages, caste still plays a significant role, especially in marriage. In the suicide case that's cited above, a caste was still being taken into account when it came to marriage, among some of the families that had been long established in the two villages. However, very much like the case cited by Kant in her article on particular suicide in Papua New Guinea, the threat of another similar suicide occurring motivated locals as a collective to discourage a repetition of this event, in this case, marriage on the basis of caste affiliation. The brutality of the suicide that severed the bodies of the young couple had the effect of severing links between villagers and an old, and what is now considered in this area, outdated form of social organization. It also served a more metaphorical purpose. The indistinguishable body parts were flung together and collected together. Whilst their union was rejected when they were alive, it had to be collectively accepted in death, in the way their bodies had become one indistinguishable mass, and in fact, they were subsequently buried together. The suicide, therefore, in its aesthetic form, changed the basis on which marriages were judged and planned, and in this way also restructured the content and form future unions and therefore future social networks would take. The gruesome sight that was met by villagers at the train tracks scarred their minds and affected their relationship with the two families involved, so much so that the boy's family left the village 4 months later. In both the cases cited, the body is used as a tool for depicting the grievances and suffering of those committing or attempting suicide. They challenge the existing social order of social relations. And now I come to my last case study, which is the suicide in the IDP camp. For 2 years following the tsunami, many of the victims were relocated to IDP camps in and around major towns and villages, and then to tsunami villages after that. People were separated in this way from the protective, kin-based social network and were forced to create new, temporary networks within their new locations. During this period, women were particularly vulnerable because lack of privacy and lack of space within the camps made them more susceptible to gender-based violence and an easy target without the protection of the family. In most cases, with large number of deaths and displacement as a result of the tsunami, the family unit was already weak and was made further vulnerable by the separation of members to new areas. Hence, the widespread reluctance of people to move away from the local setting, even in the absence of a house there. During my first period in the area, I used to visit some fishermen at an IDP camp outside Po. The fishermen had told me on numerous occasions that they were scared of leaving their wives and daughters alone in the camp. People were coming in from outside the camp and were roaming free through the area, and they didn't know many of the people there. There had been a case in the camp where a girl from Po had been raped by her father's friend in his absence on more than one occasion. This friend was from outside the camp, and they had only been acquainted a number of months. Her father's friend had threatened that if she revealed anything, he would kill her. She ended up pregnant and committed suicide by swallowing pesticide. The girl had been shamed by her father's friend, and in killing herself, she was transferring gladja, shame, from the rape onto her father for failing to protect her. The assault on her body was facilitated by a weak network of support, and in effect became an assault on the foundation of her father's family and network. Her death in this case was a reflection of the vulnerability of her own kin-based social network. Her suicide targeted her father for his inability to create a solid network of support, where the non-blood kin connections he had made were in fact the source of her abuse. The whole camp had known of the abuse, but the father did not. People within the camp did not know each other, so there was no one to take care of informing the father, and no kin to protect the daughter. People did not know who the father's friend was, and being separated from their own kin networks, they would not attempt open confrontation for fear of retaliation. In such a situation, people were more suspicious and afraid of those around them. The absence of a protective network led to increased vulnerability and an increase in violence. Almost a year after the tsunami, there were still frequent reports of gender-based violence in these camps. Although some men within the camps still had their jobs, there were many unemployed who had taken to drinking excessively. In this case, kasipu, an extremely cheap form of illicitly distilled liquor, and were becoming increasingly aggressive, resulting in many fights in the camp. In some camps in the immediate aftermath to the tsunami, women and girls had to trade sex for food. All of these instances added to the stress and was resulting in more and more cases of open aggression. And I quote Pelling here from her work in the area. The presence of strong family and community networks is what makes the difference as to who suffers most, at least in an emergency. And if communities remain intact, it is more likely that they could also remain in control of their lives. End quote. Weaker families that had remained intact after the disaster took advantage of the situation to settle scores with weakened rivals. In one case in another camp, a fisherman who belonged to a strong family network had lost many kin in the tsunami and his two boats. He was forced to accept employment on the catamaran of a small family from his village, who constantly shouted at him and humiliated him in public, calling him Podi Lamaya, little baby. Despite the public show of solidarity that followed the immediate aftermath tsunami, displaced persons were still constantly fearful and suspicious of those around them. And to quote Spencer, no public expression of good intent can offset the fears of someone convinced he or she is surrounded by enmity. And this brings me to my conclusion, which I've tentatively titled Networks of Shame. In all three cases, suicide has served as a force in bringing about a change in the nature of kin-based social network relations, or to provide a statement of the condition of these social relations. As stated at the beginning of this paper, suicide provides a series of interchanging dualities that result in the transfer of lajja, vulnerability, and status. The victim's and community's understanding of the suicide is that the responsibility lies elsewhere, away from the victim. The emotional investment required to take one's life is understood as a provocation that arises from those individuals closest to the victim, on whom the victim is dependent. As Simpson and Sariola note, to quote, the barely alive patient admitted to hospital for having taken poison has, in the eyes of the community, rendered him or herself an abject, that is, one who has sunk into a state of hopelessness, distress, and desperation. Close quote. What then becomes of interest to those involved is deciphering who is responsible for this, their descent into this state. In the case of Kapila's sister, lajja was transferred from the victim to his spouse, and the economic burden, which was at the root of his outburst, was also transferred to his wife's kin. In this situation, his wife and son, the nuclear family unit, who were seen as the source of his economic burden, now become the economic burden of his wife's kin. Her status has also been reduced from an integral member of a nuclear family unit to an offshoot dependent of her brother's social network. The root of the problem with her husband also lay in her dependency on him as the sole provider for the family, and in death, he transferred that dependency and shame back to her brother and his family network. In the case of the young couple, the suicide brought about a change in the social hierarchy in an environment where caste affiliations were no longer being adopted. The shame is embodied in the brutality of the form of the suicide and is transferred as a shared experience to the rest of the community. It thus serves as a form of social intervention. The families are shamed for subjecting not only the couple, but the whole community to the macabre event. The way in which the bodies were severed conversely severed the family's relationships with the rest of the village. Whereas in the case of the young girl's suicide in the IDP camp is a reflection of the weak support system of kin relations, as a result, the father is imbued with shame as the individual at the helm of this network. And his status falls as it becomes publicly recognized and acknowledged that he is unable to protect his family. The rape becomes a metaphor for the vulnerability of the family network to external and internal violence, while the rape itself represents violence targeting the root and source of the family, where the daughter represents the reproductive potential of her father's social network. It also comes to represent a form of internal violence where the internalization of the friend into this family network by the father has resulted in a collapse of the family unit. The subsequent suicide represents the externalization of internal violence and the definite collapse of kin network relations. What becomes evident across all three cases is the structure of social relations and communication that exists across the social network, and its ability to be remolded as a result of the forms of communication, which in this case is the suicide. While it is not always the case that suicides target immediate kin, the social context of youth suicide in Sri Lanka may shed light on internal tensions, as well as the structure and nature of social networks and relations. In particular, the narratives and discourses that accompany these violent events give indications of local ideas of well-being and the platform on which social relationships function. The dependency that is crafted by the nature of obligations defining relations between family and extended social network in a bid to create stability results in another interchanging duality, a consequent dependency on violence, both internal and external, to challenge the rigidity of these very structures. And thank you. That's it.
Thank you very much, Maurice, for a very, very clear and fine-grained discussion of an extraordinary problem. You've raised so many issues in the clear way you connect suicide to kinship networks that I'm sure there'll be many questions. I just want to open up with one question. It involves a rather obvious seeming difference between the way close kinship is enacted or practiced in Sri Lanka, perhaps, and the way it is practiced, for example, in Malta. One understands that there seem to be two sides of the coin with Sri Lankan kinship. On the one hand, compared with Malta, the obligations are extremely rigid, so rigid that you cannot bend them or be lax in fulfilling them, so that there is this sense that you have nowhere to go. It can induce despair. That wouldn't happen because a certain laxity or flexibility is built into the actual performance of obligation among close kin, I would assume, in Malta. Laxity is part of the very notion of being kin. You have obligations, but there's also a tolerance of a certain laxity. So that's one side of the coin in terms of a comparison. But the other side of the coin refers to emotion, which I agree there's now a huge anthropology of emotions. And all I would say here is that emotion, or shall I call it affection, seems to be very conditional in rural Sri Lanka. I think we associate a certain amount of affection or tolerance with being close kin. You might be upset that your sister has become a burden on you with the suicide of her husband, but you wouldn't go to the extent of blaming her so sharply for the suicide. You would also feel a certain sympathy for her under the circumstances. I get the feeling that perhaps compared with Malta, these kinds of emotions of sympathy, affection, are very conditional upon the performance of very, 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 very rigid gender roles. So perhaps you might comment on differences between Maltese kinship and Sri Lankan kinship in the context of suicide?
Well, it's a very interesting question that you ask, and actually one that has come up. And one of the things that fascinates me so much about Sri Lankan terms of kinship is that you can draw parallelisms with Malta, and especially if you look at Jeremy Wasavan's work and his descriptions of kinship in Malta pre-1994, before we had local councils, and when villages were a lot more bounded and you found a lot more families residing within the same areas. And there is that kind of parallelism. But on your second point, I think there is that emotionality with between Sri Lankans in terms of kinship. The one thing that I mentioned in the paper is that in most cases the desire is not to die. And a very important aspect, which I do deal with in another paper, is the concept of deception when it comes to Sinhalese society. They have a word which is called boru, which loosely translated means lie. But it is actually the art of deception, and there's a very nice paper written by Argenti Pillin on this, on boru, the art of deception. And it can have many different uses across different contexts, and one of them is to test people's characteristics, to test whether to get attention from others. They would invent these, create these false scenarios where they'd see how people react to these scenarios and see if they would get angry, happy, etc. And it's a way of testing character. But this, again, transfers into suicide. Suicide itself is a deception. And it can be seen from the percentage of actual successful suicides versus the percentage of acts of self-harm. And the fact that shanikakopia, quick anger, literally means that they do it there and then. And pesticides and agrochemicals are very easily available in most households. So they just quickly grab it and take the poison. But unless you take an incredible amount of pesticide, it will take between 8 and 12 hours to die, and it's excruciatingly painful. And that's so that they have enough time to actually go to the hospital and get their stomach pumped or receive treatment. And it's almost as a warning. Some interesting work that Tom Widger has been doing recently is the deception that comes into play with children suicide. So he's observed numerous cases of 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, and 8-year-olds who, in the domestic space, in the space of the household, they play out situations of suicide that they would have seen in the community, where people started where adults and youths started threatening each other with suicide over love issues, over this, over that, and it's actually, it becomes embedded, it becomes an emulation, and it loses that sense of urgency that, okay, there is the possibility that you could kill yourself. No, this is something that is normalized. It is something that is practiced. So I don't know if that actually feeds on what you're talking about, but in the sense, there is that emotionality. They do feel sadness. They do feel anger. They do feel, in fact, they feel it's because of shanikakopia. It's because they feel a surge of emotions. But that sometimes there are these miscalculations. In the case of the train suicide, they know they're going to die. The cases of the train suicide, what I've noticed is that there's a parallelism with train suicide. It's always failed love or marriages or unions which are not approved of, and therefore they are shunned by the family and cast out. They have nowhere to go. They have no support. They have no way of living. So there is no point in life. So it becomes a statement that we know this is going to target you. We know this is going to have an effect on those closest to us. There it becomes about revenge as well. But it's more calculated. There is an amount of planning. You have to walk down to the train. You have to actually build it up. And in this case, apparently, they had spent over 24 hours talking about it before they actually went through with the act.
I think that's very interesting. I attended a seminar on violence, intra-family violence, especially the abuse of wives by husbands, wife beating, in the African Studies Association in New Orleans some years ago. And one of the main speakers was making the point that his research suggested suicide is violence of husbands to wives is very discursive. A lot of talk goes on, both during the beating and before the beating. And you are giving us an interesting context here where there seems to be a whole discourse of suicide, verbal threats of suicide in the village. So it takes place in almost as a result of a discourse or a conversation that's got out of control. You know.
Thank you very much, Maurice. I thought it was a very interesting paper. I had a number of sort of questions and observations. One of them is, let's start off with one of your main points, which is that suicide clearly is a social act. And in a way, it might be worthwhile to think of it in terms of in terms of at least three different characters: the suicide, the suicided to, and the suicided for. In other words, to make it something which involves some degree of, you're talking about having an audience, having a person to whom it is directed, and having an audience. So it really involves three different, in a way, personalities, or three different actors: the person doing it, the person for whom they're doing it, and the audience who is going to make that evaluation. And in a way, it seemed to me that what your treatment was doing was following a sort of Gluckman type of approach, which is, let's use crisis to show areas of social fracture or fragmentation. When you have a crisis, you can show something like a suicide. You can really bring out certain aspects of the social structure, those areas which are particularly difficult, tense, and so on and so forth. Now, really, it seemed to me that if one takes these, you might, it's just a suggestion, there are two types of cultures, those that are suicide cultures and those that are vendetta cultures. In other words, one of which is internally directed, like the Sri Lankan one, which is almost introverted, endogamous, etc. Then there is a sort of Mediterranean type of, perhaps, I mean, you know, to crudely put it, which is if something is done which is wrong, you either get your own way, you either get back at the opposing group rather than do it to yourself. So, you know, they seem very similar because there's that intensity. But they're actually, and you were saying, they're two sides of the same coin. One of them is sort of introverted, the other one is extroverted. So it's outside, one of them is inside violence, the other one is outside directed violence. But what it does is both of them have the effect of redefining the boundaries and the loyalties and the obligations or the failure of the obligations of the group, persons towards the members of the group. It's just a suggestion. And then finally, what I just wanted to do, do you have cases of the suicides? Because it's clear that it's a performance, you're saying, you're using the word aesthetics, and as you said, it's a difficult term to employ over here because of who are dealing with people's lives. But what I want is, do you have a case of the suicides talking? I mean, you know, in other words, the ghosts. What happens to these people? Is there a continuation? Do they continue existing? You know, do they reappear in some sort of way? Do you follow? I mean, because yeah, usually in our society, dreams are a good way of redefining your obligations to people. You say, if you tell somebody, I dreamt of somebody in this country and in this and also in Cyprus and in Greece, they tell you, oh, you have to either make some prayers for them or make an offering, etc., etc. They need, their souls are needs to be put to rest or whatever. So it's just
In fact, it's very interesting that you say that because there is a paper that I'll be giving in Colombo next week, and it deals with precisely this, and it's on suicide, but it deals more with the narratives that go on in the village following a suicide or even by different classes of people. So you have people who are directly involved in terms that they are kin or related to the person who would have committed suicide, people who form the outer rims of that family group, and then also people who have a certain authority but are kind of detached but at the same time connected to the village. In this case, it's members of the Sangha, the Buddhist monks. And there are two aspects of this. One is the one that I mentioned previously, the manukaya, which is the person that lives inside of us. And there's a very interesting and quite long-winded discussion of the morality surrounding suicide and how, okay, it's the victim's family that gets blamed and the focus is all on them. And it's almost like the suicide attemptee gets yes, exactly. And but the monks are not so sure about this, and they're very hesitant about actually performing any rituals for the suicide victim. But then there's the other part, which is when they die, they have what they call the pretha. The pretha are the spirits of the dead that would have too much stored emotion, and they come back to haunt the dreams and also to haunt the bodies, the actual bodies, of those people that are closest to them. In some cases, the preta, they occupy the people, they occupy the souls of the body, the souls of the people who they either love too much or the ones that they were too angry against. And then, in that case, initially it would require a visit to the katadia, which is the sorcerer, to excommunicate the spirit from either the domestic space or from the body of the person. And if it reaches extreme circumstances, a full-blown tawil, which is an exorcism, which is normally done for demon possession, but can also be done in some cases, to a lesser extent, for pretas, spirits of the dead. And I have quite a few very interesting narratives of how they relate seeing these people in the dreams and how they relate that there is a continuing narrative even after the death of this person or the person involved. I saw them in the dream. They were talking to me and this happened and that happened. So yes, you're absolutely right. Another point is that in this area you also have a widespread. You've got what I would call a number of different cosmologies that overlap. You've got the idea that Buddhism is controls the soul and controls the way people act. And in fact, with this, they have the Sigalavada Sutra, which is how someone should act in certain circumstances, what kind of friends you should make. So it dictates very much almost like a catechism how people should act. But then you have another subculture, which brings to mind Tausig's shamanism, colonialism, and the wild man, when there's that actual particular scene where they go to the church. And after they come out of the church, he says, now for the real stuff. Let's go and drink the yage, and let's go and do this this sitting with the shaman, where there's a belief in demonology, in animism, and also in astrology, which dictate very different aspects of their lives and actually appeal to very different factions of people. But at some point, they all overlap, and it's not very clear where the boundaries are. And in this case, there is, with people who do practice demonology and who do believe in animism, you get a clearer idea of the vendetta culture that comes out, and also the direction of violence. And the argument here is that suicide targets specifically kin, and blood kin at that. And other forms of violence will target people outside of the central kin unit, the central family unit. So there's a lot of different layering to it, if you can call it.
In effect, what happens in kinship, there's too much mixing. The boundary is, if it's almost an aspect of a type of endogamy, or, you know.
Very much so, yes. It's kind of like a duality. You could say that kinship defines the boundaries, but at the same time, the boundaries define kinship. And it's a case of, you've got an interaction between local belief, between landscape, between interpretations of kin, because interpretations of kin do change as well from locality to locality, and you can find very different interpretations of kin within a space of 2 kilometers. And interpretations of morality, do they derive from Buddhism? Do they derive from animism? And all of these feed onto each other.
That might be a key, because, you know, I was just thinking of those areas where there's, and I'm going to stop over here, those areas that have a lot of suicide, which is the one I think of, which is classical Greek tragedy. I mean, the Greeks are very good at suicide. They always have them in their tragedies. I mean, you know, a tragedy can't end except unless you have about 3 or 4 at least. But the interesting thing is that it's not directed. The interesting thing in Greek tragedy is that it is not directed at others. It is the end result of a process of individuals not realizing, through hubris, through pride, a certain course of action, that the more they try to escape from their own destiny, the more they realize it. So it's completely different to what yours is, being people being pushed and not being blamed. In the case of Greek tragedy, it is them pushing others as against the norms of kinship, and as a result, something really goes bad for them, and then they commit suicide. In other words, they realize what a big mistake they've done.
Yes, in fact, there's a very interesting article that I read recently which is talking about suicide in Japan, where you actually get a mix of these two, where you've got the practice of seppuku, which is considered to be the honorable suicide, and is very much the stories that emerge, the narratives that emerge, are very similar to the Greek tragedy. And I'm really glad that you brought this up. But then there's been an increase in elderly suicide in rural localities, which bears an incredible resemblance to this situation. So it's incredible that they've sort of overlapped. And it's a bit silly, but I often wondered whether it might be the fact that at the same time Japan has got those Asian characteristics, and at the same time is a very industrialized country. And so you do find different moments and different spaces sort of living together, overlapping yet again, this intertwining of, I can't find the word for it, but... I'm sure you know what I mean. I'll stop talking. Great.
Thank you, Maurice. It's food for thought and quite disturbing. It's quite a disturbing paper. Did you ever speak to people who were unsuccessful in committing suicide? And where does that leave them into the social kinship? You know, they swallow the pesticide, insecticide, whatever it is. They went to the hospital, it was pumped out, and they lived. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how are they reintegrated? Are they integrated within the kinship structure? That's one point. And another thing, when you were talking, what was coming clear in my mind was, you know, the anthropology of the body, like the social body, like it's an assault on, it's a play within the social body, mm-hmm. not the individual body. But what they were doing is to hurt the social body through their sacrifice, kind of. Mm-hmm. Those are like my two points.
Well, again, it's very interesting that you do mention that. I have talked to a number of unsuccessful suicide attemptees. And it's an interesting part, actually, of placing the anthropologist in the field, where they have been accepted back into the family. The family actually talks about it. They talk freely about it. The family are then very, the immediate family are then very careful about, they tread carefully around them. And there is a kind of calm before the storm, but it's not really before the storm, it's after the storm. But when they do talk to me, they try to use me as a bridge between them and their family. And so I sort of become sucked into this play of deception, where they're actually, they're lying, they're not really, they're giving me different reasons for the suicide. And they know I'm going to be talking to the parents about it, and they know I'm going to be talking to the immediate family about it. So they're using me as someone who is the white man, who holds status, to try and convey that message to the family members. So it's never really very clear what they actually want to say. It's clear what they want to impart, but what the reasons for the suicide actually were and what they're trying to achieve out of it, because you do get into caught in this web of deception again, which is like a couple of other situations.
Are they shunned, or is it like relief? He didn't run it, so Aurora has been saved.
That depends on the status of the family. If it's a dominant family, they're usually shunned, because that lowers the status considerably. So they're not very respected within the village anymore. If they're not a dominant family network, if they're not part of a dominant family network, they're usually very careful not to allow it to happen again and to loosen their grip on those individuals, which makes sense, I mean, in that context.
When you mentioned the point on the aesthetic, I remember the case of Bouazizi's self-immolation in Tunisia.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if any of these suicides in your context somehow, whether they were carried out in a public space or posted in the public space of the internet, say, or images or YouTube or news or anything, has instigated a sort of political action on a grassroots level. I mean, you know how Bouazizi's suicide has instigated and is known to be the beginning of the Arab Revolution. Now, definitely this is not the context, but is it among the younger generation, perhaps, instigating any form of debate or any form of, you know, standing up to their dominant parents or anything to do with the economic situation, for example, with unemployment or something like that?
Well, it's interesting that you do mention that. First of all, there is self-immolation in Sri Lanka, but it's mostly in the East. It's very, very common in the East, actually. There's a very good paper by De Alwis, called Young Girl Burning in My Head. It was one of the papers of a special issue on suicide, and particularly suicide in Sri Lanka and South Asia, contributions to Indian sociology, that came out at it was the last issue of 2012. It's suicide in Sri Lanka in this format has been recorded ever since the 16th century. when Robert Knox, I don't know if you've heard of Robert Knox, who was a captive in the Candian Kingdom for 19 years. He wrote, he then managed to escape, and he's got some very clear accounts of the prevalence and violence of violence and suicide in Sri Lanka. So it has been something that's been going on for quite a while. What has happened is that there's a reaction now, since it was brought to the attention at the end of the 90s that Sri Lanka had the highest rate of suicide in the world at that time. To reduce the numbers of suicides, but that doesn't mean that the actual number of suicides or acts of self-harm have actually gone down. It just means that less are being reported and a lot more are being reported as accidents, etc., etc. There hasn't really been that much of, as you say, a kind of an uprising or a revolution, because it's become so ingrained. Well, this is my assumption, but it's become so ingrained that it's, and they've, as Simpson says, they've become so desensitized to violence over the years and to destruction and to critical events. I mean, one of the aspects that I find difficult to define in this context is people ask me, what is normalcy? How do you restore normalcy? And this is extremely significant in the aftermath of the tsunami. People say, oh, there's a move back to normalcy, but we don't know what normalcy is there. Because you've had disaster after disaster, you've had conflicts after conflicts, you have a constant violence between people, lots of cases of Shanika Kopya, not only reserved to suicide, but also to murders, to torture, to etc., etc. That it's difficult to tell. There is an interesting, a very interesting article called Twice Killed, which looks at two cases of self-immolation, and one of them which was largely ignored. This was in Czech Republic. But basically, it's talking about two cases of self-immolation, one that went largely unnoticed, and the other one that was very much noticed because it was held at a critical time in public. And in the case of Sri Lanka, most of the suicides, when they do commit suicide, it's a case of grabbing the pesticide and running out in a public space because they want people to see them. They want people to experience this. And the reaction is, in even that recorded in a lot of the narratives, is, look at me, look at what you're doing to me, look at my body, etc. There was another interesting article which was on suicide bombing and why suicide bombing is so scarring and receives so much media attention, especially in the context of Israel and Palestine, is because the suicide bomber, as a Palestinian, blows themselves up with other people, but they're mixing the blood. There's this whole discourse of what you get in Mary Douglas's Purity and Danger, where that's what's so appalling. And there's another article which deals with Zaka, the Haredi, which is this particular group of Hasidic Jews, which actually have a very ambivalent position in Israeli society, because they actually go and onto sites where there have been terrorist bombings, etc., and there's all the blood, and they collect the victims. And this is seen as something which goes against their traditional beliefs, that you should not be handling blood, you should not be handling other people's remains. So that's why it's also so scarring in this particular context. And I think that's consciously what they're trying to achieve. What they've noticed as well is that a lot of the people who actually do try to commit suicide bombers are already, most of them have their bodies already scarred. And it's a kind of a duality where they their bodies have been scarred, and they are trying to scar others' bodies to sort of extract a vendetta for the scarring that was done onto them. So this is really then where the body becomes a kind of social performance in a way, or a tool for social for performance.
So thanks a lot for a very interesting paper. One thing I was thinking about is the third case, the rape case. And I was comparing it to the ancient Roman story of Lucretia. Lucretia was upheld in the ancient Roman world to be a role model for women. It starts with exactly the same situation. She was threatened to, she had the choice, either be raped or be killed. She, the honorable way of going about it, and that is why she ended up being a role model, was she accepted to submit to the rape, informed her family, asked her family to avenge her, committed suicide, thereby renewing her honor, so to speak. And that case basically ended up in a revolution against the Etruscan kings. So it is, in a way, almost an identical situation with a completely different conclusion. In the ancient Roman story, the guilt is moved towards the aggressor. In the Sri Lankan case, the guilt is moved towards the family. What would you say keeps the guilt within the family? And from what you said, I don't get the feeling that there was an expectation on the family to avenge the rape in the Sri Lankan case. So what element in Sri Lankan society keeps the guilt within the family and not towards the aggressor?
Because from the narratives that I've collected, I mean, at least most people understand it. Not most people, but they understand suicides to be targeting kin. Therefore, something that a failing on the side of on the part of a close family. In this case as well, in this particular case of the rape case, they had their family network had been completely almost completely destroyed by tsunami, so they were already very vulnerable. They didn't have a strong social network. The man who was involved, who he had befriended, he wasn't part of the camp. He was coming into the camp. People didn't know him. He had a strong network outside. There was very little he could do to avenge that. You are only able to avenge debts in this context if you've got a network of support, because of the kind of retaliation that you would get otherwise. So I don't know if that goes very far into answering your question, but it is something I would like to maybe actually explore a bit more. It is an interesting question that I don't think I've considered fully in this case. The idea of guilt. I mean, the idea of guilt is something that is played with in other contexts in Sri Lanka. I haven't really seen in what ways it's constantly directed at the family, actually. So it's an interesting point. Thanks.
For example, in Arabic countries, if a woman is raped, then the guilt is on the woman and not on the aggressor. Isn't it like that in Sri Lanka? I don't know.
Well, if a woman is raped in Sri Lanka? Not in it actually changes from case to case. It depends what family the woman belongs to, and it depends on the situation, who the aggressor is, and how the woman is raped. And even in that case, because of this whole underlying theme of deception, this could go into actually a very wide discussion, because they have other terms which are called irisiawa. Irisiawa means jealousy, and there's always a lot of competition between families and between households. So if it's a rape, I've come across the situation where there's been a rape and the aggressor is not known, but the woman would say like, oh, I don't have close relations with these people, so I'm going to target them. And they can actually pass the blame on to other people to try and exact revenge, because it's seen as something very taboo. And usually, actually, people do take, in at least in this part of Sri Lanka, they take rape very seriously. It really does depend on the context. I wouldn't want to be too direct in saying that it is like this or it is like that. But there is a paper which is very interesting that, I'm sorry, I'm just shooting out references here and there, by Yasmin Tambaya, who did a lot of research in Colombo City on the rape of homosexual men. When it becomes known that they are homosexual, that the police actually do target them and for public humiliation. I mean, rape in most cases is done for humiliation rather than anything else. And she compares this with, I think, the rape of women in similar contexts. And then there's a whole discussion on gender fluidity and all this. But apart from that, that's about as much as I can say about it.
And you mentioned that you have some narratives regarding the collective subconscious of the family. So I would be interested in it.
Collective subconscious of families.
You mentioned some kind of narratives.
Of the Manukaya.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, the Manukaya, which is the other person that resides within us. They believe that there are two people inside of you, and one of them operates the subconscious, and it comes alive during the dreams. And they gave me one very interesting one, which is it's believed all over Sri Lanka. Because I've met a number of people who have told me about this. There was this woman who was undergoing an operation. And after the operation, she was interviewed by television because she told them, my Manukaya went out of my body and I was at the top of the room, and she described the operation in detail for detail. Then the doctors were surprised, the surgeons were surprised, like, whoa, how did she know that? And there was a golden rail passing through the middle, and she was on this golden rail, and on one side she had the demons and the devils pulling her, and the other side she had the gods, the devale, pulling her on the other side, and she was screaming because they were trying to pull her on both sides. And then she came too, and that was like one narrative of the Manukaya. And the other one, I've had some other people in the village saying, I went on a trip yesterday. And I said, last night? Where did you go? I said, no, not me, the Manukaya. I tell you, I went there and I met this person I haven't seen for a long time. And it's the subconscious mind which is traveling. There's actually, I'm not sure if I should say this, but there's a very interesting anthropologist that Durham University, Ian Edgar, who does a lot of work on dreams, and is now going to be doing a BBC program on dreams in different cultures and how they are interpreted. And this could be, I wonder if he'd actually be doing something on Sri Lanka. That would be very interesting to see this whole concept of dreaming, etc.
Maybe I misunderstood something, but it has nothing to do with the family then, right? It's not a personal subconscious. It's not.
No. It's a personal subconscious. It's literally another person that lives within you. And that's why suicide is considered to be murder, because you're not just taking away your life, you're taking away the other person's life who lives within you. Yeah, that's it. And
is taking the Amanukaya's life worse than taking your own life?
Well, no, I mean, it's sort of evolved into a discourse. There's a very different discourse that goes on between the monks, the Sangha, and the villagers, whereas the narratives that I collect and the discourse that goes on in the village, they actually say that... remind me of the question again, the last part.
Whether suicide is actually bad because it's... Because you're taking away the life of the Amanukaya rather than your own.
No, the way they see it is that murder is not good, because you have the precepts of Buddhism that say that murder is an abomination, and you have five main precepts, in, at least in Sinhalese Buddhism. One of them is again Neganepa, you do not appropriate anybody else's property or steal, etc. Hesirima pa, which is Hesirima something pa, which is don't engage in adultery. Boru pa, don't lie. Bonne pa, don't take alcohol, or it implies drugs as well. And Maranne pa, which is don't kill. And those are the five precepts. So to fit into the context of the five precepts, it's not about you taking your life away. It becomes more of an idea of you killing somebody else. Therefore, you're committing murder, because that maranepa is don't murder, don't kill. And that's the way it gets explained. It's not so bad if you die yourself, you know, but it's more that you're killing somebody else, and that sort of makes people... I think it probably makes people feel more guilty at the same time.
You said that the suicide culture has become ingrained within the culture of the village, to the extent that even children are emulating it and that sort of thing. Has it, because you said that the suicides are mainly directed at family and kinship, they want to send a message.
Uh-huh.
Has this trend, this the fact that these suicides are increasing, has it not led to any kind of soul searching? Has it not led to any form of social change with regards to kinship relationships, or the fact that, for example, individuals might feel too much controlled, for example, in certain cases, or too much, oppressed. It depends on the case, on why the person is committing suicide, because the grievance is not always the same, obviously.
No, it's not.
So I seem to get the impression that the suicides are serving more to consolidate traditions and traditional values, and strengthening kinship networks in the sense of the concept of kinship, rather than leading to a rethink, so to speak, or to some soul searching, which might lead to certain cultural changes and maybe less suicides.
Well, it's an interesting point that you're making. Again, I'd bring in this the idea of the ambivalence of kin. I don't think it leads to that much change and questioning of kin relations, because of the fact that they are so dependent on the kin at the same time. That's why it's an ambivalence. They're so dependent on the tight kin relations to retain that stability and to retain that kind of that power as well within their own community, because these are pretty much insular communities. So it kind of goes both ways. The other thing is, yes, it has changed slightly on the coastal areas of Sri Lanka. I mean, you find now a higher rate of suicide inland rather than you do on the coast. And the reason for that is that, especially since the tsunami, and this is one of the things that I'm very fascinated about with the tsunami, is that it brought through not just the wave, the actual tsunami wave, but a wave of development which has opened up villages and towns, so that the boundaries between villages are more porous, and people can actually, social mobility as well as geographical mobility has increased. So people don't have to necessarily stay within their own village. They have started moving now. So there's a lot more independence, there's a lot more individualism. Still not to a large extent, but it's more than it was, let's say, 8 years ago when I first went there. It could be another possible way out, and that's one of the things which I'd be fascinated to see, and I would like to see how it develops, because it's still a very recent development, and obviously these things take time. So I'd be curious to see if it is actually because of that. So in terms of that, I don't know. I don't know if it has changed or if it is going to change very drastically, but there are small changes. You do notice it in the numbers as well, and in the frequency. Again, in the aftermath of the tsunami, there was a lot more vulnerability, there were a lot more opportunities for suicide, so it could be that it's just decreased since then. I wasn't there before tsunami, so I cannot really tell. But since the aftermath of the tsunami, till now, till recently, till 2012, the amount of suicides has gone down to a considerable extent in coastal zones, especially where there are tourists.
But another aspect of the question you were just asked refers to increased social commentary or social criticism. For example, in the country with which I'm most familiar, Nigeria, there's a very, very lively, big press, many, many newspapers. And when, for example, a rash of murders takes place or some form of ritual killing is discussed, there's bound to be a lot of commentary in the newspapers about it. And so I think an aspect of the question also is, has there, in Colombo or Kandy, yeah, or any of the other cities, are the media talking about this in Sri Lanka, or is it below their attention, and if so, why?
Actually, that's a lovely question, because one of the things that I really enjoy doing is going on the Sri Lankan Daily Mirror, which is one of the online newspapers. But the thing about the Sri Lankan Daily Mirror is that the people who mostly read it and read these online English newspapers are people in Colombo of a certain status, of a certain class. And the southern district of Matra, where I do most of my research, is very particular, very, very particular in comparison to the other districts because of the widespread practice of sorcery, of even certain aspects of voodoo, which is Hunyan and Sunyam, and the belief in demonism and demons and exorcisms and all of these which are associated with it. So, which is the...
And yet the suicide is not just in southern Sri Lanka.
It's
nationwide, and it's very high.
But one aspect of it is that whenever it's something that's connected with southern Sri Lanka, there's a whole list of commentary that says, oh, it's because it's the southerners, oh, it's because of them, and that they drag Sri Lanka into the mud. When there is suicide, there is a lot of commentary, and the commentary is very varied. Some people say, oh, what a shame, I pray for the family and for the victims, etc., da 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 da. And others would say, oh, what a stupid idiot. So you get a variety, literally a variety. There isn't any dominance in the kind of narratives that you find there. But then again, you're talking about a readership of people who have received a very Western education and are very limited in number as well. So I don't think it would be actually a very accurate representation of the general population. It is people literally who reside in Colombo or are from very upper class elite families. Yeah, I mean, on other things like the distinctions between people from the north and people from the south, that is very clear in the comments on the newspaper. But in terms of representativeness of commentary on suicides, that doesn't come out very much.
Related to this, to the same question, more or less, you're talking about sort of tourism. So linking again to even to Durkheim, to Durkheim's idea of suicide.
Uh-huh.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Durkheim said the more a society becomes specialized, the rate of suicide falls.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you link that to the economic side of things, okay, uh-huh. Economic affluency, tourism, and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Is it the same case in Sri Lanka? Does suicide fall when the economic side of things are higher than certain areas? And again, linked to Professor Clough's first statement regarding emotions.
Mm.
He sort of made a comparison between Malta, Mediterranean form of saying, okay, there is there is affection towards, for example, women when their husband committed suicide. Well, in this case, in Sri Lanka, doesn't seem to be the case.
Mm.
And your own account, one of your narratives says no shame. She doesn't have shame. Going back to that, isn't that a form of guilt? You are imposing guilt upon...
In that case, yeah, but that's because her brother got burdened with her and her son, so he's got to now take care of them both economically, etc. So he was lashing out with anger. In other situations where you've got a similar situation, you don't always get the same narrative, so it's a bit difficult to just say, no, this is the way it happens. It does depend on the context and on the economic situation of the family in question. I've already forgotten your first question.
Because of Durkheim, basically.
Durkheim.
The difference between the economic elite, if you want to say that, or rather the ones that are the areas where, again, you have tourism and you have a certain level of economic affluency that is higher than others.
Well, that's a bit of a tricky question, because even when you've got like an area which is exposed to tourism, you're also going to be getting what they call a lot more vices coming in, which can expose people to more shameful incidents, which actually then can also lead to suicide. And when you've got tourism within a certain area, usually the developments and the enterprises that are taking place over there are headed by elite families. In the elite families, you don't really find many cases of suicides. Very, 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 very few. It's mostly among the lower classes, the poorer people, etc. I'm sure that if you have a stronger economic situation within a particular area, That you would have a decrease in the amount of suicides. But the problem with this is, and I'll be talking about this tomorrow, is that you get, for example, a village that becomes tourism directed, you'll have one dominant family that starts to become the village elite class and takes control of the material resources that are available there. So in actual fact, you'll have one family that's benefiting. They will have a much wider network, but they're also that wider network will be based on patron-client relationship. So there's still that kind of, there's still that same hierarchy. It doesn't really, really change that much in that context. The other point with Durkheim is I haven't mentioned Durkheim in this paper, although a lot of it does build on Durkheim's approach. The only problem I have with Durkheim is that he outlines four specific types of suicide, which is altruistic, egotistic. And I have a problem with his categorization and separation of the four, which I was hoping that in the narrative of this paper and in the examples given out, even though I don't refer to it explicitly, that you can see that there is an overlap between the four and that the aspects of it do come out. And this is my problem with splitting them up into specific categories. The other problem with Durkheim, even though I want to emphasize the social aspects, is that Durkheim focuses solely on the social and excludes the biological and the and the medical side of suicides, which does come into play. A very good example of this of the fusion between the two would be Simpson and Sariola's paper, which is on bioethics and on clinical trials and with suicide victims in Sri Lanka and various clinics in Sri Lanka. So, yeah.
But I think another criticism of Durkheim would, or his relevance, not a criticism of Durkheim, but of his relevance to the Sri Lankan case, is that all his different categories do assume a society in which individuals are pretty strongly defined and have a pretty strong individual identity. Yes, and have had this throughout written history. Whereas I think Sri Lanka sounds like a society in where the distinction between the individual and the society is not all that clear. Where social obligations are so overriding that people define themselves in terms of the society. In other words, there's the individual at the heart of Durkheim's analysis.
Yeah, in fact, and I mean, the thing with Sri Lanka, again, is the fuzziness of all these boundaries and the divisions. It's never really clear what constitutes the village, what constitutes the family, what constitutes individual priorities, and what constructs the individual, what constructs the family unit, what constructs the network. This is the thing that Paola can have so many, Paola, which was the word for family, but can also be used for wife, it can be used for the whole village, and in the context of poor, can be used for the family social network. It can be used in so many different contexts, and that's it. It's very, very fuzzy what it means, what the terminologies they use actually mean. The same thing with Buru, with Amma, with sister, with brother, with etc. They can be used in many, many different contexts. And it sort of points to an inability on their part to define their own situations, because the situations are themselves fluid. They're constantly changing. They're constantly evolving. And that's why in the abstract of the paper, I say the fluidity of status means that power and also the extent of the network can be easily lost, won, or changed completely.
Just one last question, Maurice. There have been many references in your paper to violence at large in Sri Lankan society. And I remember when I was working with you on your MA, I was particularly struck by the high levels of violence. And yeah, you've just mentioned other anthropologists who say, like Spencer, uh-huh, and Simpson. I think it was Simpson who said that in Sri Lanka, the general level of violence is such that people are desensitized to violence, and therefore they more readily commit not only violence on themselves, but a kind of suicide which is directed to destroy or damage others. Now, would you like to comment on that? Do you think in your final apparatus of explanation of suicide in Sri Lanka, do you think the general violence in the society is going to be an important feature in your explanation?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the violence, it can take on many different forms and can be directed at many at different people. You've got humiliation, which is a very important aspect, and that in itself is a form of violence. There are many instances of symbolic violence as well, which...
You also talk about a lot of physical violence.
There are so many
cases of sheer physical violence in your village. I mean, the willingness with which a game of cards dissolves into not merely fisticuffs, but serious injury done by one to another, maiming for life. It seems to me that this is a society in which the very notion of the body as an intrinsic or terribly vital part of the person is almost lacking. They're willing to gash bodies, maim bodies, in a way which we would regard as shocking. Does this feed into your explanation?
Well, it does. In fact, I mean, my doctoral fieldwork now was done in a village which was close to the village I was working in before, and it's composed mainly of fishermen. And one of the things that I remember writing about was that most of them would walk around the main area with no tops and machetes in the sarongs, and each one of them had battle scars. And it was basically, you show off that, you know, we are a fighting village and we've got this to show. And they'd all be without the tops, and they'd all look menacingly at it. And I don't want to sort of exoticize it at all, but you do see that the body does become a sort of almost like an ID card. We are members of this place, we're members of that. And violence does erupt. It's this Shanika copy, again, is used in this context as well. There was that one example, which I think I had used for my masters, I don't know if you remember, where I had gone to a bar frequented by a lot of fishermen, to say bye to a couple of fishermen friends of mine, and around 10 meters away from our own table, there was another group of fishermen who were drinking, and one of them tipped over the glass of the other, and a fight ensued where they both got up, one pulled out the machete, the boy who was working, who was an 18-year-old boy and a friend of ours from the village, went in to separate them and got his arm chopped off by the machete. And I remember there was screaming, blood, and my fisherman very quickly grabbed me, pulled me away from the back entrance, and I was very squeamish, and they literally had to carry me. And they were, what I do remember in particular very vividly was, as they were walking, they were laughing and joking as if nothing had happened. And that just showed me how much of an everyday thing this was, and that, I think, illustrates the desensitization to it. In the case of Simpson, he's talking specifically about the Civil War, which I would go beyond that as well. The Civil War was a big part of it, but as we were discussing one time, it was mainly concentrated in the North and the East, but you had a lot of young men from the South who went up to the Civil War and came down maimed, completely maimed, and were just hidden away in villages around the coast and hidden from sight because the government did not want to see, people did not want to show this. It was almost like a show of vulnerability. It's kind of like the situation that you have, that Frank Ferretti talks about when you have, he was talking about two particular floods that occurred in the same place in the UK. But one took place just a few years after the Blitz. And the media reports were all about brave England and how strong they were and how everyone was supporting each other to keep on that image of the Blitz and of people supporting each other and the strength. And the same thing happened, flood took place again in the 1990s, and the focus was all on the vulnerability of people and on stories of pity, even though it was the same. So you had the shift, you know, but I don't know how I got onto that last example, but...
Is there a gender element to all this, for example, with regards to suicide?
Uh-huh.
Is suicide more common among men or among women?
Well,
Can I ask you something else? With regards to this type of violence you were describing just now, I suppose there is also a macho element, no? I think it involves men much more than women, showing
the marks of violence. Is it a man thing?
Yeah, and there are very different interpretations of masculinity. From what I've gathered from my narratives, from the narratives collected and from what people say and the way people act, is that you have certain characteristics or certain definitions of masculinity where that are accepted within the domestic space. But once you emerge from the domestic space and you're in the public village area, you have another definition of what masculinity is. And depending where you go, the ideas of masculinity change according to the area, according to the livelihood, according to who the people you are with. But yes, it is very much a male thing. To be honest, I don't have very much access to women. It's not very easy to talk to women over there, and it's not very approved of, at least in the context of the villages. The few women that I do talk to are the wives of my very, very close friends. But apart from that, you don't get much information about women. But there is Jean Mersek of Swarthmore College. She has written extensively on suicide and really focusing on suicide in terms of women. And most of the time, it's linked to domestic cases of domestic violence. And them being separated, when a woman gets married, she goes to live with the man's family. So she's separated from her nuclear unit, from her blood family. So yes, it is understandable there. In terms of rates of suicide, numbers of suicide, there are more cases of men's suicide. Globally, there are always more cases of men's suicide. In the case of Sri Lanka, there are more cases of men's suicide, but not by that much. Sri Lanka has actually the second highest rate of women's suicide, second only to China, which has the highest rate and has some very interesting cases of women's suicide. Does that answer your questions? Yeah, okay.
Maurice, this is a very sad topic, a very disturbing topic, but I'm afraid to say that it's also a very significant one. So fortunately or unfortunately, I hope we hear much more from you on the topic of suicide, and we wish you well in your three-month trip to Sri Lanka, which is about to begin. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.